Health information fiduciaries are organizations that we, as the American people, entrust with access to all of our health information. They run a growing library of decision support to help us interpret our information and guide us towards each of the steps in our journey. And more importantly, help us to know to get care when we otherwise don't feel that ill and we're feeling pretty fine and healthy, but we may have been missing out on some of the key preventive services that we otherwise should be getting. Or if I'm starting to feel a bit ill, to route me to the right providers that can get me the care I need in a more high quality, less intense manner. And so the debate simply, in my view, is that who will own a health information fiduciary service? Should it be my health plan? Should it be my provider? Should it be this new accountable care organization? Should it be a direct-to-consumer that's totally disconnected from the industry? But these key principles have to be in place, and that's my moonshot to bring it to life.
Welcome to A&M Healthcare Industry Group's What's Your Moonshot podcast series, where world-class healthcare leaders seek to solve big problems. Listen as we talk to today's health system CEOs about the journey to achieve their moonshots.
Welcome to Alvarez and Marsal's What's Your Moonshot podcast series. My name is Martin McGann. I'm a managing director and head of Alvarez and Marsal's healthcare industry group. Of course, I'm joined by my co-host, A&M senior advisor, Dr. David Shokin, Ninth Secretary of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Good afternoon, David.
Hey, Martin. Good to be with you again.
And today, really thrilled to have Anish Chopra, who's the president of Care Journey, join us today. As is with the case with all of our Moonshot series, I'm always amazed by how much I learn, but specifically having talked to you and worked with you on several items, I always learn something from you, Anish. So this is a huge thrill for me, and we're excited to hear about your Moonshot today.
Well, thanks for having me.
In a brief words, do you want to describe maybe in broad case, kind of a general overview of what you would classify as a Moonshot?
I see future new entrant to the healthcare marketplace, operating what we call as health information fiduciaries. So I want to create a new class of products. Health information fiduciaries are organizations that we as the American people entrust with access to all of our health information. They run a growing library of decision support to help us interpret our information and guide us towards each of the steps in our journey. And more importantly, help us to know to get care when we otherwise don't feel that ill and we're feeling pretty fine and healthy, but we may have been missing out on some of the key preventive services that we otherwise should be getting. Or if I'm starting to feel a bit ill, to route me to the right providers that can get me the care I need in a more high quality, less intense manner. And so almost nudging me along the way towards the delivery system that we have. And this dream, in many ways, harkens back to the Blue Button Initiative that President Obama announced and Secretary Shulkin helped bring to life at the VA, where we recognized that the original provisions of interoperability were for people to have access to their own data. HIPAA has a provision, the right of access, and that we should be able to pull our information. Now, at the time when the VA launched it, you were downloading it to your hard drive. And I think veterans were printing it out and keeping a copy for their records because it was like a safe thing that they had access to. When President Obama announced the Precision Medicine Initiative, he followed up to say, well, wait a minute. Part of this vision is that you should be able to not only have access to your information, but to the applications and services that can help you make sense of it. And that, to me, is the beginning of an application era, a marketplace. And so the debate simply, in my view, is that who will own a health information fiduciary service? Should it be my health plan? Should it be my provider? Should it be this new accountable care organization? Should it be a direct-to-consumer that's totally disconnected from the industry? But these key principles have to be in place, and that's my moonshot to bring it to life.
Well, Anish, you know, this concept of a fiduciary is probably going to be a new concept to some of our listeners. And so, why is it necessary to have an intermediary? Why can't the patient be the owner directly? And are there examples outside of healthcare where fiduciaries actually do function in the way you're talking about?
Well, let's start with where the term fiduciary came up in my mind as it relates to this work. As you may or may not recall, the Labor Department in the Obama administration introduced a fiduciary rule on 401k plan administrators. Now, to take a minute to derail the background, the Economic Council and the Council of Economic Advisors wrote a paper very early in the Obama administration that estimated something like $4 trillion of money flowing through this retirement system. There were billions of dollars of it that were wasted in the form of excess fees. That is to say, the individual was directed to put their money in plans that paid the most fees to the 401k broker. And that if the person was able to go to a different product that had maybe a different profile that's more attuned to what the person actually wanted, that gap from what should have been the recommendation and what was the recommendation was billions of dollars of retirement money that was taken away from people, effectively put into the hands of the brokers. And so the fiduciary rule was a proposal to say, if you're going to manage a 401k account and the employer is going to set one up, the advice you give must be in the best interests of the person, not of the business model of the sponsor of the entity. And so let's just be pragmatic about it to get to spiciness on the podcast. If I'm a health system and I have a sizable chunk of my profitability tied to 340B, and the patient has a choice, let's just take their blindness, the macular degeneration drug. It's a Part B injectable drug. There's a $50 version, $2,500, $3,500, multiple versions. So a fiduciary might know my limits financially. I owe 20% copay for Medicare, and might recommend that I go to a doctor that's going to give me a compounded version of Avastin first, or I should ask for that at $50 with a 20% copay, better than a $3,500, which is clinically equivalent. But if you're a health system, you get a huge discount on the drug and it's a big profit center. So is it possible for your digital systems, and would it be appropriate for them to navigate someone towards that which is going to hurt your profitability? That'll be difficult. And so these issues around benefits navigation, Amazon PillPack noted that when they first introduced the idea of buying drugs on Amazon Pharmacy, that 40% of people, when presented a cash price relative to the benefit price, chose the cash price. Ironically, only half the time it was because it was cheaper. The other half was I could fill it on the 28th day and not wait for the, you know, prescription to be expired and then be re-upped. So the convenience factor. So I actually think your idea that the patient owns the data is right. They can essentially grant permission to the fiduciary to interpret it. And I think that way the fiduciary moonshot is not in opposition to your idea of ownership rights, but it's functionally the same. I designate the app with permission to access the information and give me the decision support.
So it's interesting because I think your perspective is unique. You obviously, we talked about Care Journey, president of Care Journey. That transparency into data and patient information is part of it, but also your experience, you know, within the government. In 2009, you were appointed by President Obama as the first U.S. Chief Technology Officer for the organization. So your view on data, I think, coming from a private but also a public perspective, is unique. But let's talk about healthcare data. And one thing we're really good at in healthcare is generating data, but using data might be our hill that we have to climb. What's your perspective from a consumer's perspective, even on how you start unpacking data, how you start using it, and how this moonshot would assist in that from the patient's perspective?
Well, it would be remiss on my part to not acknowledge the remarkable changes on account of November 2022, the release of ChatGPT. And so to kind of make this real, and then I'll lift up, Peter Lee used to work at DARPA. He's now the head of Microsoft Research and has been focusing a lot on their healthcare roadmap. Peter used to work with me on a number of projects and inspired me to believe in this idea of substitutable applications. He created one for the military, for the warfighter. He did some social media projects on the Red Balloon Challenge. So I've had history and respected him. He uploaded his most recent lab results. He's a relatively healthy guy. And he put it into the kind of secure version of GPT-4 that Microsoft Azure supports. And he asked the simple question, is there anything in my lab results that I should be concerned about? That's it. No, I need to spend $100 million building a data warehouse and mapping all the data and, you know, developing a library of analytics, you know, none of that. One prompt. And it knew to write the query, load the data, understood what some of these terms mean because it's gotten smarter and smarter on the publicly available, you know, diagnosis codes and everything else. And it basically says, look, you're generally healthy, but you've got this potential iron overload disorder. And he's got this description about the recommended next steps. Here's my point. It's a weird thing. It's like a tale of three. It's like a movie in three acts. Act one, we have data in healthcare. We generate it everywhere, but it's inert. It doesn't move. So if the entity that has the data isn't motivated to use the data, then it doesn't get the full value. And in this case of the fiduciary, as I shared earlier, a lot of these queries are not necessarily in the best interest of the data holder, so they don't get run. Forget AI, just I don't want to run that query. Don't give me a list of patients that could get the $50 because I'm trying to make sure that the 340B math works. Number two, we move the data. Chapter two now is now it can move from the place it's at to the place it's going. And so we saw this as an example, data moving in the care journey world, it moves to the risk-bearing primary care doctors, the independent doctors who've been successful, who want to use the data, who are motivated to use the data, in fact, incentivized to use the data for my best interests. But they lack the technical sophistication in many cases. So for them, it was an administrative burden to interpret the data. So that there's that I can get the data, but I don't know if I can use the data because it's expensive and complex to do that. And now we're entering in this third chapter where now it's no longer expensive to interact with the data. So hopefully with liquidity, data liquidity to the consumer and to the risk-bearing physicians who we trust, we can get our information in the hands of people who now have the means, the tools with AI to interpret it and then to work with me on making the best decisions at every step of my journey.
Well, Anish, that was very helpful. And, you know, I always describe you as a guy who stopped working for government a long time ago. But all that I really mean by that is you stopped getting a paycheck from government. You continue to work on this vision and mission. And the way you just described it puts together really many of the things that I've seen you work on over these past couple of years. I do want to go back to with Peter Lee's example of being able to enter his own data into a generative AI platform and get answers. Is the fiduciary, can it be technology run, or does there need to be a clinical input into it, you know, a human input?
So you're raising a brilliant question. If you go to Rock Health, they do a survey every year of who would you trust with your information? And technology apps themselves, let's call it big tech, way at the bottom, like sub 10% trust. Your doctor, way at the top. Now, not 90% trust. I think in the last survey, the numbers have all fallen, but it's still in aggregate. The physicians trusted the most, the big tech is the least. So that clinical input and interpretation, until we reach the point of, you know, AI healthcare superintelligence, which is coming, but not here now, it is that you want the physician to interpret. You want that physician to have the benefit of AI to guide and nudge and recommend and prompt what may be, you know, a potential area for them to engage. Mm-hmm. And so that idea of physician as co-pilot, or the term a human in the loop, providing feedback to the AI system, or a nurse that says, hey, look, I found this to be clinically useful, or I didn't. That will only help to train the models to make them better. But I do agree it will more likely to be a clinician-facing service, which is actually the bet Care Journey's making, which is that our business interests are aligned with accountable care organizations who have a financial incentive and then the technical access to the data in order to put these pieces together.
From a patient perspective, what impact do you think this has the greatest health benefit? Are you thinking it is more about preventive services and looking proactively at disease prevention? Or are you seeing this more as chronic care management and addressing the gaps in care and the, you know, decisions on an acute basis? You know, I'm not feeling well today and I need to go into my healthcare data and figure out what do I do next?
I love that question, David, because there's a lot of humility here to say, I don't know, a third, but let's just stay, but let's start with first principles. If I ask the CDC, what's the rate of hypertension in our society, and more specifically, uncontrolled hypertension? There's a number and a survey-based number. If I go to the IT systems in a given geography where those surveys indicate it's X, half of that population is documented in a system. Half. So we have a documentation. At a minimum, we need to bring light where there's darkness. So that's called that, you call that prevention, but let's just say we want an accurate picture of the prevalence of disease. And if we had the accurate picture, then we want a learning health system that will constantly evolve to say, here's the best protocol. And it may be more and more personalized over time. So it's not so much nagging me to get the colonoscopy. It's about saying, Anish, given your risk factors, I believe you have a very high probability of colon cancer. And if you don't diagnose it early, you will unfortunately die. So let me put you in this category of high risk to get colon cancer. Therefore, put more, give them the Lyft voucher or the Uber voucher, get them to the clinic, give them all the support. Geisinger ran an example like this where they said, look, we all have care gaps. Everyone's got care gaps. There's nothing new to this audience. But by running an AI model, they identified the flip side. Who is the most likely to be positive for cancer? And then let's get them screened. To give you orders of magnitude, David, on a memory here, so don't quote me exactly. Typical positive test ratios for every 150 people screened, one positive for cancer, right? So colon cancer screening, 1 to 150. In the cohort sorted by those most likely to have cancer, 1 out of 10. And by detecting it early, they just extended probability of life years way out. So it's all three. It's identifying disease early. It's a chronic program to get you the interventions you need now that we've understood who you are, where you are. And then on the acute crisis, it's making sure that we've got you routed to the right facilities that can care for people with uncontrolled X or Y. That's the opportunity that's in front of us.
So to get the next steps in that transparency of data, and I loved your third chapter of we have it, then you can transport it, and now we have to use it. What do you need to get? What do you need to in the next step to get to the moonshot of getting that transparency?
Yeah. So at the moment, we have on paper the rules we need to move the data where it goes. But for those listening who heard me say that a few minutes ago and are like scratching their heads, like, that's not my life, dude. I don't have the proverbial blue button. I can't move my data around. There's a lot of non-technical burden. So the rules are on the books, but they haven't really been built into the DNA of how we operate the healthcare system. So in my view, it's a little bit of that all hands on deck. Back to David's discussion, there's no one care journey of vendor is not going to auto magically vendorize this problem. This is a societal multi-stakeholder issue. There's some technical work to be done. So a doctor can raise his or her hand and say, I want all the records for my population. For the plan to recognize that doctor and know which patients are associated with them in a treatment relationship. And then once that's asserted, to share the data. We're there, Martin, on the rules, but operations, we've got 2 or 3 years ahead of us to kind of clean up. And then we need culture change. So do primary care doctors want to introduce the health information fiduciary service at all? Do they want to expand the scope of what a primary care practice does to add this? Or is that, hey, I may earn the trust, but I don't have the capacity to run that service. So it's going to have to be the TurboTax people down the street. It's going to have to be some new co we've never heard of. It ain't going to be me. So that's a little bit about where we are. The supply side is molding where it needs to mold with some demand signal early to shape it, but it's going to take a little bit more of that non-technical trade barrier, as they say, to unleash.
Well, Anish, you know, on this podcast, we love moonshots and we love your moonshot. And we know that that's how they become reality, by dreaming the way that you are and defining this. But one of the things in healthcare that we've all learned is that even when something makes a great deal of sense and shows a lot of benefit, there's a force that's quite significant to keep the status quo, to prevent these things from happening. So where do you think the biggest barriers will be to this moonshot? Who do you think actually might want to work against it and just continue the way that we don't use data?
We have plenty of organizations that rely on opacity to hide a lot of the mess. Yeah. And let's not call it nefarious, because it could be that I'm taking a loss on this service line and I really want to keep the service line. So I'm going to really boost my reimbursement in another service line and I'm going to cross subsidize. So if somebody had full transparency and they cherry picked out all of my excess profits from the service lines that were supporting the needed service line, someone's going to have to pay for that. And so opacity today, we can all kind of close our eyes and hope that the thing, broadly speaking, moves forward, even if it's not effective and efficient. So that's an issue. The number one counterweight to that is by making the burden of pushing the button so low that you can't really say it's burdensome to support it. So anyone that holds the data today can say, well, I don't know if I can trust security-wise and privacy rights-wise my trading partner. So absent the support, I'm not going to turn on the pipe. But if the pipe is sort of ready out of the box and it's already got a lot of the security built in, it's hard for me to defend against not turning the pipe on. And you see at this point now, consumer access to Blue Button is now the default. Price transparency is basically now iterating towards a default. And so it's almost like the industry is waking up to say, we're going to have to deal with the ugly truth that a lot which is private and opaque is now becoming public and transparent. And so debate now is, do I just sit in the corner and just cry and say, stop this madness? Or do I go on offense and find business models that I can support that take advantage of that? And I hope more of the industry is going to move towards the offense side than just the pushing back and holding back on defense.
Yeah. Great. Look, I think Dr. Shulkin's correct, is there's reluctance. And I think you're right. Sometimes it's not nefarious. It's just reluctance to do this. But there's real world, I guess the counterbalance is there's, you see risk out there. And the real risk, the headline one is Change Healthcare, obviously, which happened, you know, about 2 months ago. And still feeling effects in our clients today about the impact of change. And that was had nothing to do with sharing of information. That was their information. And
I want to hear the counterbalance
of sharing all of this out there. And if you press a button, is it gone forever? Is it safe? Right.
So that's what I love about this moment in time. These middleware vendors, the BAAs, effectively treat secondary data rights as their intellectual property. And we in healthcare have accepted it because HIPAA allows it. So it became a market. And in many ways, what happened with Change is, I assume the reason they had such a large database is that it was the secondary use database, not the transactional hub that may not necessarily need to store anything. You know, if you broke into the hub and you were watching the traffic on the network, it's really the residual data warehouse that was kept afterwards. Why? For secondary use. So that's like almost like the worst case scenario. It's not even my data. My data's gotten, quote, de-identified and it's going to be made available. So that's a little bit of a challenge. In the API world, in the data sharing world, where I have clear lines of sight, the applications that are trusted to get the data are the only ones that will get the data. And if I revoke that trust, they're cut off. This opacity. How many Americans know that Change is sitting on all their data? What rights do I have to say to Change, give me a copy of all the data you have on me so I know it? It's not a thing.
Yeah.
And so in this case, it does create more agency I call it opening up while locking down. You're actually creating secure pipes that have less kind of exfiltration and reusability. But so the pipes can flow, but you can revoke and you can manage. And the society is going to decide who gets to revoke and manage. Can party A revoke, or do I, the consumer, have to revoke? And, you know, what's opt in, what's opt out? All that's to be discussed. But at the moment, think of the change catalyst as an accelerant, not a headwind, on the journey towards a fiduciary.
Anish, my final question as we begin to sort of wrap up your moonshot is, in order to propel this forward, in order for this to really work through many of the issues that you've talked about, do you see this as a private sector solution? Do you see this as government needs to be the one leading the way? Or do you see this as a private-public partnership? And if so, who really takes the lead to move this forward?
Yeah, I love this question, Mr. Secretary, because I see the greatest leverage to make the healthcare system better at the intersection of the public and the private sector. We need rules of the road that are enforced to kind of get the liquidity that we deserve. But we need the private sector to develop the technical standards for privacy and security, the AI-based applications that can run the decision support that's in our best interests. And that yin and yang will come together. If it's done right, it's an open marketplace on the foundation of a more healthcare transparent system. So that's the hope. Now, your comment about the government has two hats. Government as regulator is where I talk about the public-private. The VA, CMS, they're operators. And there's no reason why they can't be as at the table equal to the payers and providers around them. And so you know that it is inevitable that there will be R&D funding and challenge.gov initiatives. In fact, as we're recording today, ARPA-H did just put out a solicitation on ideas to bring a chatbot experience to basically Blue Button. And so without getting into the full details, it kind of is almost like a down payment on this vision, which I think is an example of where government can play a catalytic role, a regulatory role, but ultimately it's the private sector that's going to build the business model and the technical chassis on which it's going to be judged useful or not by the American people.
Here at A&M, we pride ourselves on helping our clients, whether they be providers, whether they be health systems, whether they be plans, the health plans, really kind of do operational change and be proactive and be practical. In addition to doing their very important work, which is caring for patients, if someone's found this podcast today, what would be the one thing that you would say to a health care provider CEO or a health plan CEO to think about? Because I've learned a lot in talking to you that I think this is coming. How it manifests itself and the path it gets there, it maybe didn't change around, but it's coming. What are the things that they need to think about in their online business?
Governance. To me, the answer is simple. Team A, Team B. Team A is running the play you know to run, operationally effective. Team B says, if we had a service on whatever chassis we have that is akin to the fiduciary, we're the plan and we can be the kind of the in-house plan fiduciary. We're the provider. We want to be the in-house fiduciary. Because both parties are going to be able to share data with each other, it almost doesn't matter what hat you wear. Everyone that you mentioned could have a Team B. And Team B would say, hey, optimize from the bottom up. Get a half a dozen patients, get a clinic, a test bed, a market, an area, a D-SNP plan, and demonstrate what that would look like. And let's see how far do we go on the business model that we have today, or we could have adjacent, and whether or not we achieve not only our own financial and corporate objectives, but also that kind of surplus value to the consumer. And that may be a useful exercise. At a minimum, you're dog fooding the idea and the policy to learn as a test bed. We may uncover all of the gaps that exist if the fiduciary says do X, but our business model assumes that Y would happen forever. That may be a flag, and that we should be prepared for that, almost like a scenario plan. And so I think team A, team B, I'll leave you with this final comment. My successor at the White House is Todd Park, who I worship, love, hug him with all my heart and mind and soul. He was at the heart of the healthcare.gov rescue. And at the governance level, reporting to the president, which is the role that we had, there was a big operational nightmare. You can't literally, in the middle of the crisis, rip out, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of IT spend. But you also don't want to patchwork a thing and like stumble your way to the finish line. So Todd was able to basically field, let's call it a dozen engineers at a house that they rented in suburban Maryland and said, you're going to rebuild pieces of the application and we're going to still have our legacy, you know, application and we're going to meet in open enrollment two the next year. And I'm going to make a decision almost like Shark Tank style. And in fact, what they were able to do is team B had enough functionality ready that they could make that the first entry point for the consumer. And then only for those that couldn't meet the specific use cases that were supported, did you kick back into the legacy team. So Todd was able to run team B and team A and found a way to systems integrate because A, he's an incredible leader, but B, the moment demanded it. And so I think the moment today with the prevalence of generative AI, with the liquidity of data to consumers and physicians, this is the moment to have that team be launched and learn.
Great. Well, we can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast and sharing your moonshot. We think it's a great one. And as Martin said, inevitably, we think it needs to happen and will happen. So thank you for being part of this today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Anish, thank you very much. And we're going to check back with you because I think this is iterative and it's going to continue to progress and you can continue to educate all of us. So we will definitely check back with you. Thank you.
I love it. Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right. Thanks, Anish.
Alvarez and Marcel, leadership, action, results.
So, Martin, you know, whenever I hear Anish speak, I'm always amazed at how brilliant this guy is and how much he cares about really continuing to see this vision of using healthcare technology and data better. But I always feel like I might only understand about half of what he says. You know, he's at a different level.
I'm glad you said that. That makes me feel better with my 1/8 of what I am.
But, you know, when you listen to somebody like him, you say, wow, you know, it's going to take people like him to really get us to the next level. And it does seem to me that we are seeing a transition where companies that had data for many years were about controlling that data, even somewhat commoditizing that data. And now I think these same companies have understood that that just isn't going to fly anymore. So that this data availability is coming, this interoperability of data. And now with this integration of AI, there's a way potentially of using that data. So we really are at a time that his type of moonshot may actually become possible.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. It's, you know, data was always thought of an asset, and data was always if you had more and you could utilize it better for your own organization, that was an asset. And now I think that is changing. And what I really love and appreciate about Anish's approach is it really does remain patient-centric. It's what's best, yes, for the clinicians that. For the companies, how do the patients utilize this sharing of information to get better care? And that could be through transparency, it could be through advocacy, it could be everyone sharing seamlessly, but it's about the patient, right? And he has so much knowledge about the regulatory side, about the private sector side, but he still keeps that forefront, which is important not to lose in this entire journey that we're doing.
What I loved about your last question to Anish about, you know, what would you be doing if you're sitting at one of these organizations and you know, the clients that A&M serves. I think that's a really important question because, you know, we've seen this before where particularly healthcare providers have taken sort of a backseat role to some of the significant challenges, and they find themselves then being on the very passive end as sort of the external environment hits them. And I do worry about that here. If you're running a health system or you're running a health plan and you say, you know, I'm just going to sit back and watch this and see how it impacts me, I do think the technology companies here may have an ability to leapfrog and really control this access to data and that relationship with the patient. And so I think that that's why the leaders of these organizations really do need to heed Anisha's advice and think about, are they thinking about what is their role in the future vision of what this healthcare system is going to look like?
Yeah, it was brilliant practical advice. It's you have to do your job. You have to continue to run sometimes really large organizations that have their own challenges, but create a group of people, this is Team B, to get smart on this, to think about what you can do first, because it can overwhelm you. I'll be honest with you, just trying to understand everything and trying to digest all of this, it can paralyze you. And people don't like to be paralyzed, so they opt out, to your point. But what can you do on a Team B to say, how do I get up the learning curve? You're not going to jump straight up to the top, but what are the practical components of making that next step? It's really important, and it was really good advice to anyone how to approach this. So I agree with you. And again, Dr. Shulkin, I love how you put these together, because you've been in the patient care business, you've been in the provider business, you've run complex organizations. Nothing is more complex than the VA itself, but you also understand that the solutions have to come too. And tapping into the brain power of Anish and others tackling this is making it practical. So it's a really interesting thing, even for an old guy like myself to try to understand and apply.
Well, thanks, Martin. As always, I enjoyed it. And thanks for doing this today. I think both of us learned a lot.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much. And we look forward to seeing everybody else on future episodes. Thanks so much.
Great. Bye-bye.